Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For the chronically obese, stomach reduction surgery can look like a godsend. An obesity epidemic plus high-profile cases like Weatherman Al Roker and singer Carney Wilson losing hundreds of pounds after going under the knife have prompted a growing number of overweight Americans to do the same. More than 100,000 patients chose to have their stomachs surgically truncated this year, and a growing percentage of those are just teenagers. Tonight on Point, sizing up the surgical solution to America's supersized waistlines. But first, the SEC today announced new proposals to stop abuses at mutual fund companies. This comes as the mutual fund industry is swept up in the worst scandal of its history. Deborah Solomon covers the SEC for the Wall Street Journal. I asked her to describe the new proposals.
They're going to try and crack down on a couple of things, late trading and market timing, which have been the subject of much discussion over the past few weeks. One of the things they're going to do is they've proposed requiring that all orders are received by the mutual fund companies by 4 p.m. What that means is that if you're a mutual fund investor and you want to get out of a fund or buy into a fund, you're probably going to have to do it a lot earlier than the close of market, which is 4 p.m., because your broker or your intermediary who deals with that is going to have to get all the orders for all of their clients to the funds by 4 p.m.
So the point of this would be to prevent late trading, where some investors have been advantaged by trading at today's price after the closing bell.
Right. And that came to light this fall when New York Attorney General Eliot Spitzer settled with a hedge fund that was alleged to have gamed the market and late traded at the expense of other investors.
Slamming the door on that would end that problem, but might it not disadvantage some investors? If you have to get your trade in very early in the day, does that put, let's say, 401k investors at a disadvantage compared to people who can trade right up to 4 p.m.?
Well, that's a concern, and one of the commissioners said today that the only reason he was voting to allow the proposal to go forward was because the SEC is also putting forward an alternative, which would permit funds to accept orders after 4 p.m. and provide them with the same day's price, as long as the intermediary uses audit procedures and can track to make sure that the person isn't gaming the market, isn't trying to late trade.
And what about market timing, this kind of very rapid trading of mutual funds, again, that's been given to kind of privileged investors as an option?
Right. Well, the plan that they're floating today would require fund companies to tell investors about the risks that are posed by frequent buying and selling of fund shares, and would also require all the funds to specifically state their policies on market timing. But it wouldn't prohibit it. I mean, it basically leaves it up to the fund and tells the fund that they have to disclose what their policies are.
So, Deborah, is this it? Is this the big reform? Is it enough? Is it too little too late?
It's just the first step. I mean, they seem to have come a little late to the party, but they seem like they're going to spend the next couple of months putting forward some more proposals. Next month, in fact, they're going to do a couple of other things. Actually, later this month, they're going to propose requiring improvements to fund boards. And they're also going to, in February, propose a mandatory redemption fee to try and crack down on market timing. So basically, if you trade in and out of a fund quickly, you'd get dinged because you'd have to pay a redemption fee. That's going to come in February. They're looking at better governance, having three-quarters of the fund board to be independent, which isn't something different than we've seen before. So there's a whole slate of things that they're still planning to do over the next couple of months.
So on one track, the SEC is trying to tighten up the whole system. On another track, the scandals continue to multiply and unfold. We saw just in the last day or two new charges against Invesco, the head of Strong Capital stepping down. What's moving faster here, the scandal or the efforts to rein it in?
Well, I think the scandal has gotten way ahead of the efforts to rein it in. I mean, they're just now getting started on proposing rules, but like any government agency, it will take a long time for them to actually put these things in place. I mean, they have to have a comment period, then they have to go back and take a look at those comments, see if they need to tweak the rules. It's going to be a few months before we actually see any changes, and then they'll usually give the fund companies some time to comply. The thing is that when you have a scandal like this breaking, most funds are trying to do some of this stuff on their own anyway so that they can go to the SEC and say, look, we've changed our practices. We're not not doing these kinds of things anymore. So in case there are problems at that fund, or in case the SEC starts poking around, they can say, look, we're being proactive and we're not just waiting for you to tell us to do this.
And in oversight terms, is the SEC finally driving the bus again, or are they still behind New York's Elliot Spitzer, even the U.S. Congress, which put some bill forward last month?
Well, I think they're all on the same train. I mean, I think they're all trying to drive this together. The SEC was somewhat late to the mutual fund scandal, although they have been looking at some other issues like fee disclosure and sales practices, and they've been leading the charge on that. So, you know, I think they're all kind of in this together, and we'll just have to wait and see what kind of criminal charges we see from some of the attorney generals and the kind of civil penalties that the SEC brings to these firms.
What's the sense at the SEC today, Deborah Solomon? Can they move in such a way as to bolster public investor confidence in mutual funds? And can they adequately oversee this big mutual funds industry to make sure that this doesn't happen again?
That's a big concern. Whether they can oversee it, they need more staff. They need to sort of get ahead of problems. They're trying to set up this new Office of Risk Assessment so that they can see ahead of the curve, figure out what problems are coming down the pike before they become huge issues in the industry. They've had a poor budget for years. They've just finally gotten some funding. They're just starting to hire new people. So I think you're going to start to see them getting, you know, more proactive and more aggressive in this area. Whether investors will feel confident, I think that it's going to be like the accounting scandals where you just have to let it play out before people feel comfortable getting back into the market. Whether the SEC can do anything to assure investors that they're taking care of the problems, doing things like settling with Putnam, taking action against Invesco, you know, I think they're trying to give investors a level of comfort, but I think that we'll have a few more months of scandal-plagued mutual fund.
At this point, the mutual fund industry may welcome the SEC moves just to help them get their reputations polished back up.
That's true. And I think they're looking for the SEC to have rules that they have to follow so that they can go to their shareholders or their investors and say, look, you know, these are the rules that we're supposed to comply with. We are complying with them. The SEC is policing us adequately and effectively, so you don't need to be scared about getting into funds. But then again, there are people out there who say that investors should be leaving some of these funds because they didn't have compliance. They were taking advantage of investors, and they shouldn't be able to keep their clients.
Deborah Solomon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Deborah Solomon covers the SEC for the Wall Street Journal. She spoke with me from Washington. More than a third of Americans are considered obese. Many have tried diet pills and weight loss programs, only to watch their waistlines and health problems balloon anyway. Faced with aching joints, debilitating heart disease, and diabetes, a rising number of the country's most obese citizens are looking to a more drastic solution, stomach reduction surgery. The stomach shrinking procedure has been embraced by celebrities who show up suddenly slim on magazine covers, and by tens of thousands of others who just do it. But as more obese American adults and a growing number of teenagers turn to surgery, some critics are asking if taking stomach stapling mainstream is the right answer to a big problem. Tonight on Point, the explosion in surgery for obesity. Is this the answer, an answer, to America's obesity problem? Is this a rational response to obesity or a sign of some kind of cultural failure or both? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Scott Shikora, Surgical Director of the Obesity Consult Center at Tufts New England Medical Center. He's done over 1,000 stomach reduction surgeries. Good evening and welcome, Scott Shikora.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for being with us, Doctor. Take us into this. You have described the explosion in this surgery that's going on. How do you see that? How is this growing out of the obesity epidemic that we've heard so much about? How do these two things relate?
Well, over the last decade or so, obesity has exploded in America and also worldwide. Right now, 97 million Americans are overweight and 15 million are morbidly obese, where they weigh approximately 100 pounds or 100% over their ideal body weight.
Morbidly obese, that's a medical term.
Correct.
Sounds bad.
It is, because many of these people have additional comorbid conditions such as diabetes, high blood pressure, sleep apnea, poor quality of life.
Sleep apnea is being awakened during sleep because of weight?
Or it's a condition related to weight where it disrupts sleep, breathing. They choke, they gag.
So people aren't just overweight. They're suffering real
consequences in their health because
absolutely. The majority of these patients have significant medical problems to go along with their obesity, and these medical problems, by and large, get better with significant weight loss.
Mm-hmm.
So at the same time that you have this explosion in obesity throughout the United States, these procedures that actually have been around for almost 50 years are becoming safer and more efficacious.
Who's a candidate for stomach reduction surgery?
Well, currently there are very, very strict guidelines, and these guidelines were established by the National Institute of Health in 1991. And these guidelines include being 100 pounds or 100% over your ideal body weight.
So, in other words, morbidly obese, as you define it.
You would have to have attempted non-surgical weight loss in the past.
So exercise and diet.
Weight Watchers, one of the other programs, medications, you name it. And in addition, you have to be screened by a multidisciplinary program, behavioral therapists, dietitians, medical doctors, to be deemed a candidate.
So in other words, very overweight, morbidly obese, to be technical about it, and you've tried other options, they haven't worked, and you're a candidate for this. I've read that something like 10 million Americans might be candidates now, and the standards could be changed to make that 30 million Americans eligible soon. What's that about?
Well, currently, 10 to 15 million Americans would qualify based on those standards. But as more and more data comes out about the efficacy of these procedures and with increasing safety to these procedures, it's now becoming evident that we're missing a large population of Americans that are diabetic, that have heart disease or diabetes, high blood pressure related to their weight, who would not qualify for surgery. So there is actually emphasis underway to possibly lower the standards a little bit so that people who maybe don't weigh 100 pounds over their ideal body weight but weigh 80 pounds would qualify.
Because they're having other secondary effects that are detrimental to their health.
Correct.
All right. Tell us, how does this surgery work? What is it exactly? And I know there's more than one, but give us the when people say stomach stapling, what does that mean?
Well, the gist of it is reducing the capacity of the stomach from something that's comparable to about a quart to something that's comparable to about 1 ounce.
And how's that done? A quart. So that reduces it by what percentage? Hugely reduces it.
Oh, it's over 90%.
You take away, you somehow block off 90% of the stomach?
That's correct.
How?
Well, for the gastric bypass, which is the gold standard procedure in the United States, we actually use stapling devices to partition the stomach into two segments. One segment is 1 ounce, and then everything else is the remainder.
Once it's done, can you ever undo it, or is it done?
It's meant to be permanent.
And so now you've just got 10% of the stomach, let's say, at work. What does that do to eating habits? What does it do to weight?
Well, it dramatically changes eating habits. It reduces the capacity of what one can eat at a given meal. And over the course of the day, calorie intake is dramatically reduced.
So give us an example in very concrete terms of what might that downsizing of the intake be.
Well, I guess typical Americans must eat 3,000 to 4,000 calories a day. And after this procedure, for the first year or so, patients generally will eat 700 to 900 calories a day.
Which would be considered by most people with normal stomachs extraordinarily low intake.
Correct, and extremely difficult to do.
Do the patients find it difficult after the stomach has had the surgery?
There's an adjustment period.
I mean, do they feel hungry all the time?
No, actually what's interesting is for the first 6 months after surgery, they have absolutely no appetite, and they have to remind themselves to even eat their meals. Beyond that, because the stomach is only an ounce in size, once they put a small amount of food in that little stomach, they're full. They're not hungry.
So what's the typical weight loss after the surgery then? What's the curve look like? How much, how fast?
For the gastric bypass, we will typically see patients lose two-thirds of their excess body weight in 12 months.
So if I'm 100 pounds overweight, I'll lose 75 or some 60, 70 pounds of that within a year.
That's correct. And that's the average. Some people do better than that.
So on balance, a good thing? This growing, exploding, to you, use your word, number of stomach reduction surgeries?
Well, I believe so, and I think the literature will also support that because it's been demonstrated that although the surgery does have risk, and there have been complications that have been well-publicized of late, the risk...
Including some deaths on the operating table.
one death in the operating table in Rhode Island,
mm-hmm.
but the risks of the surgery are less than the risks of untreated obesity.
And in a nutshell, couldn't these people just get on a treadmill or, have less fried chicken? Doesn't it seem like an expensive, radical intervention?
Rationally, one would think that, but most of these people are intelligent, functional folks. If they were mm-hmm. able to do that, they would have. There's a lot stacked against them. Obesity is a genetic problem. It's a social problem. It's an environmental problem. It's a behavioral problem.
We're going to hear about all of that. We're so glad you're here, Scott Shikora. We're talking tonight about Obese America's boom in stomach reduction surgery, the explosion in radical surgical intervention to fight fat. Is this the answer, an answer, to America's obesity problem? Is surgery the right answer to obesity? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Obese America's boom in stomach reduction surgery, stomach stapling, you may have heard it called, the explosion in radical surgical intervention to fight fat. You can join our conversation tonight. Is surgery the right answer to obesity? Has your stomach been stapled? Why did you do it? And should insurance companies be paying for stomach stapling at $25,000 a pop? Is this the way to deal with America's obesity epidemic, or at least an important tool in the arsenal? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been talking tonight in the studio with Dr. Scott Shikora. He's surgical director at the Obesity Consult Center at Tufts New England Medical Center. We're joined now from Cleveland, Ohio, by Paul Ernsberger. He's associate professor of nutrition at Case Western Reserve University. Good evening and welcome, Paul Ernsberger.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us. You have been a fairly outspoken critic of stomach reduction surgery. Why?
Well, it leads to nutritional deficiencies. It leads to deficiencies of just about every nutrient that you can think of. You don't see this during the honeymoon period of the first year or two as people are losing weight, but over the long run, you see osteoporosis, the wasting away of bones, deficiencies in calcium, in the B vitamins. Most patients in the long run are going to need regular injections of vitamin B12, for example, because you've eliminated the stomach. You've deliberately sabotaged the digestive system, and it won't work right.
Now, is this simply because the calorie intake becomes so low that there's not enough nutrition moving through the body?
No, the gastric bypass is designed to cause malabsorption. Normally,
malabsorption, meaning the stomach doesn't do its normal digestion, and so the nutrients simply aren't absorbed even if they pass through the digestive tract,
yes.
Or so to speak, what's left of it.
Let's follow a piece of food. Normally it goes into the stomach, it becomes acidified, it's dissolved, and then it's very slowly and carefully, in a concert of different hormonal signals, it's released into the small intestine,
okay.
into the duodenum, the initial part of the small intestine, and there most of the nutrients are absorbed. After the surgery, only a tiny part of the stomach comes in contact with the food, and it's dumped deep into the intestine, far past the initial segment, very deep. And so the amount of all nutrients, not just calories, but vitamins, minerals, and everything else, is sharply reduced. And this is purposeful.
So, I mean, that's exactly why the weight reduction goes on, because essentially the food just moves through. It's not absorbed into the system. But, of course, there's a calculation, I guess, that's being made here that the health risks of the obesity that preceded the surgery were so great that we'll get to Scott Shikora in a minute to see if he agrees with your analysis of what goes on, but that the advantages is, or the risks of not having the surgery are so great that it's worth it. What do you say to that, Paul Ernsberger?
That is a huge myth. There's been a tremendous exaggeration of the risks of obesity, even severe obesity. The epidemiology doesn't bear it out. Certainly it's a risk. So if you have a body mass index over 40, which we would call severe obesity, it's going to take 5 or even 10 years off your life expectancy. So instead of living to age 75, you're going to live to age 70.
That is, without the surgery and without weight loss.
That's correct. So it's as bad as smoking, which is severe. But this is very drastic surgery, and if we're doing it on teenagers in particular, We're talking about people who, without the surgery, would have another 50, 60 years of life expectancy.
So why do you think that? Why do you think this surgery is growing so much in its application, Paul Ernstberger? If as you see it, it's not so hot.
Well, it's a tremendous gold rush. I know there are a number of hospitals across the country that would have to close their doors if it weren't for weight loss surgery.
You're saying it's lucrative for the medical industry?
Well, yes, and there's high fees. People are in the hospital. 20% of people have to go back in the hospital because of complications or reoperations. So it's tremendously profitable.
Scott Shakura, I see by your body language you've got a very long list of objections here. Let's hear them.
I think I would need an hour to reply to all of his points. I agree in part with what he's saying about micronutrients, meaning vitamins and minerals. That may be malabsorbed after gastric bypass, but that's easy to manage if you're following your patients religiously. And if you supplement.
You mean taking vitamins, having vitamin injections, that kind of thing?
Correct, and checking vitamin levels every 6 months.
Okay.
The majority of these patients would trade that in a heartbeat not to be shooting insulin or sleeping at night with a breathing machine because they have sleep apnea. There has also been a study that's looked at a group of diabetics who had obesity surgery and compared them to a matched control group who didn't have surgery but would have if they could have. These patients either were denied surgery by their insurance carrier or were deemed for other reasons not to be candidates. The death rate was 4.5 times higher in the non-surgical group. And it's been demonstrated in numerous studies that the cost of health care after surgery is reduced,
that's
medication costs are reduced, and these patients' quality of life has dramatically increased.
So you're saying even in economic terms, even if the surgery costs $25,000, whatever it is, it may be worth it in the long term?
That is correct. You're reducing medication costs alone to a fraction. Yeah, you are.
Paul Ernstberger, we hear you there.
Well, there's been one controlled study of this done. A Swedish obese subjects study was done in Sweden, and they looked at the costs for a control group that was treated with diet alone versus a paired group that got the surgery. And what they found was that, yes, you save money on high blood pressure and cholesterol medication and diabetes medication, but there's increased costs associated with pain medication, GI medication, and also the vitamin supplements and tests, and also people going back into the hospital. And so it was a wash. The total costs were the same, and the amount of hospitalization was greater in the surgical group.
I see from the shaking head right here with me in the studio that there's not consensus on this.
I tend to disagree. Our patients rarely are readmitted. After a week or so from this point of surgery on, they're not on pain medicine. They're on no GI medicines. Most of them are living a life they couldn't dream of living when they were heavy. And there are other studies that have demonstrated very clearly that hospitalizations are dramatically reduced. And even for patients who are readmitted for the same medical problems, their length of stay in the hospital is shorter after surgery than before.
Let's hear from our listeners. Melanie's calling from Boston. Hi, Melanie. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I'm a therapist in Boston, and I work doing, in part, doing evals for people who are going through gastric bypass.
What kind of therapist, Melanie? Like physical therapist or?
No, mental health.
Mental health therapist, all right.
So before they have the surgery, they need to come see a mental health professional.
Yes, as Scott Shakura referred to that, right. Okay, what do you hear? What do you see?
I see some mixed things. I have some clients who have done very, very well. In particular, I have an MR, two MR clients who have done extremely well after the surgery.
MR?
Mental retardation.
Okay, okay.
In part because they're so very used to following strict behavioral guidelines. And I think that ultimately this is a major issue, that the clients that I'm seeing that are not successful aren't able to follow behavioral guidelines, which is why things like Weight Watchers aren't working for them.
You're saying because after the surgery it's necessary to be able to follow behavioral guidelines, or before?
Absolutely.
It would have...
Oh, absolutely. Before, I mean, I think before is important as well, but after, I've seen clients who have gone through the surgery, have had honeymoon periods of a year or two, and then come back and their weight has ballooned back up again.
How is that possible? They only have 10% of their stomach left.
No, but they learn to cheat, and I think they learn to sort of get around some of the issues, and the stomach does stretch out again.
I've got to come back and look at that, but just as a therapist, from what you've seen, are you comfortable with this, Melanie? Overall, does this seem like this explosion in this surgery is a good thing?
No, not at all.
Why?
Not as a cure to the obesity problem in our country.
So what's a better alternative?
I don't know. I think that ultimately we really need to start working with parents and kids at young ages.
So what's the problem with it then? Why do you think it's not a solution?
It's a radical solution that doesn't address the number one problem, which is that kids are not being taught good nutritional value and how to maintain their health and how to exercise and how to control those things.
Melanie, we've got it, and thank you for your call. Scott Shikora, first of all, the weight can come back?
Yes.
With 90% of the stomach gone and malabsorption and all the rest, how does that happen?
Well, first of all, the malabsorption is mostly for the micronutrients, the vitamins, the minerals. These patients will absorb the calories and the protein quite well.
Okay.
The gastric bypass is more a restrictive procedure, limiting what you can eat and not a malabsorptive procedure.
But if what you can eat is so limited, how does the stomach, take on enough capacity to make you fat again?
Well, it's an eating condition that we call grazing, which is nibbling and noshing all day long.
Well, you're blaming the patient. It's actually it's normal biology. The stomach will adapt, and the intestine will adapt. The meal size starts to increase from 6 months after surgery, and within 2 years, patients can eat normal-sized meals again. And that's not because they're grazing. That's because of biology.
Paul Linsberg, are you saying the stomach actually balloons again somehow, or it's just kept full all day long?
No, it will expand and stretch so that the capacity, if you put in some saline or give them a barium swallow, you'll see that it's enlarged.
Scott Shikora?
It will enlarge some, but not dramatically. And in fact, 75 to 80% of patients will maintain half their excess weight loss. There are studies that demonstrate it out 20 years now. So the majority of patients, if they're well selected, if they're well prepared, and I agree with Melanie, they need a lot of behavioral management. We have three behavioral therapists in our program, and they're the linchpin of our program.
Mm-hmm.
And we have perpetual follow-up. And as long as those conditions are intact, the majority of patients at our program, our success rate's almost 90%.
Melanie raised.
I don't believe that, because that is based on the patients who come back in, who volunteer to come back in. If you track down the patients who are lost to follow up, almost all of them have regained all of the weight.
Scott Shikora, do you lose patients in the follow up?
Of course we do. Patients move around, they don't come back.
Yeah.
But unlike other conditions where patients won't come back if they have problems, in this situation, most of them come back when they have problems. Walter Pores did a study where he had 97% follow-up, and he had the same results.
Scott, Paul, stand by. Our caller raised this issue of young Americans and how they're educated and how this surgery intersects with their lives. I want to turn to that by going to Houston, Texas, where we're joined by Dr. Mary Brandt. She's professor of surgery and associate professor of pediatrics at Baylor College of Medicine. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Brandt.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
We are also joined now from New Albany, Indiana, by Keely Kark. She's a 20-year-old sophomore college student. She had stomach reduction surgery when she was 19. She had it in January at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Good evening and welcome, Keely Kark.
Hi.
Keely Kark, to you first. How did you and your family decide that this was the right path for you at 19 years of age?
Well, we had tried all of the diet pills. We had gone to our family physician, and we've done the diets. We've joined Jenny Craig. We've joined Weight Watchers.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a gym out there that offers a program, we've been there.
Mm-hmm.
And the results weren't happening. And they did testing, and they found out that there are problems from the obesity. And it had been suggested, well, they do staple stomachs now. You could have an operation to help you lose weight. And it was. It's a serious choice. It's something you really have to think about. And as I investigated it more, I found out this is for life. There are things you have to do every day for the rest of your life.
Such as?
Take vitamins, 2 multivitamins
right.
a day. You have to eat properly. You have to make sure you're getting enough protein. You have to drink so many ounces of water every day.
So you're handling your digestive system becomes a kind of a daily matter of attention, though, of course, in some ways, I guess it is for everyone. But did you get the weight loss? Where did you start out, and where are you now, going on a year later?
I started at 363 the day of surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And yesterday, actually, I went to the doctor and I weighed in and I was at 228.
So that's a big weight loss. Do you feel better, Keely?
Of course. If you're not carrying around 130 excess pounds, you're going to feel better, too.
Mary Brandt, you, as I understand it, were earlier not so crazy about young people getting the surgery, and you've come around. Have I got that right, and why?
Well, in manner of speaking, this actually started in our institution. I'm a pediatric surgeon, first
yes.
of all, so treat exclusively children.
Mm-hmm.
And we have an expert, William Klisch, who is a famous pediatric obesity expert, who approached me about 2 years ago and said, you need to learn how to do bariatric surgery. And I can't repeat on the air exactly how I responded to that, but I thought it was absolutely crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with a lot of the callers previously. It's certainly not the ultimate solution. But what happened in the process was, as I began to meet some of these kids and realized that they were 350, 400 pounds, on insulin, with heart failure, with liver failure, sleeping with a machine at home because they had sleep apnea, and had really, truly tried everything, that we were withholding the only therapy that's been proven to work in this patient population, and that wasn't right.
Help us understand from a lay perspective, when you say they'd tried everything, I mean, are there people for whom weight loss is simply not possible without surgery, Mary Brandt?
I think it's a lot like smoking, to be honest with you. And I think where we are in our society right now is sort of at the Surgeon General's report, if you will, in the 1960s. We've created a huge medical problem, a health problem, because there hasn't been consciousness about this issue.
But how is it like smoking? I mean, people know that it doesn't feel great and it's not terribly healthy to be overweight.
Exactly. I think if you look at the obesity epidemic now, where smoking was in the 1960s, and it takes time for society to realize what the problem is, and adjust. But even though there's lots of people who know how horrible smoking is and have tried over and over to quit, there's a small group that simply can't. And I think that for whatever genetic or social reason, that's probably true in obesity as well. And there's always going to be a subset of patients that going to the gym and trying diets is not going to work.
So how do you see the surgery working out now for young patients? For Keely Karka is with us so far, at almost a year after the surgery. She's fairly satisfied, though it's created a new regimen for her that requires very close discipline. But how does it work out for young people? Do we really know the long-term effects yet?
We actually don't, and I think that's a very important point to bring up. I'm a member of the American Pediatric Surgical Association Outcomes Group, And I have to give credit where credit's due, actually, to Keeley's surgeon, I'm sure, Dr. Tom Inge, who's been a real leader in this. But we identified in pediatric surgery about 2 years ago that there was a huge issue and that there were children that were being done, but that we didn't know if that was going to be effective or not in the long term. So a group of us have basically designed a study and agreed that we will follow these children for a minimum of 10 years, and we hope 15 or 20, so that we can, at the end of this, say whether the risk truly is less than the benefit.
Keely Karka, when you look ahead, what do you think? Are you perfectly confident that you've done the right thing here? Are you concerned that you may have long-term consequences from the surgery?
I feel fairly confident right now that I did do the right thing,
mm-hmm.
because I did have complications from this surgery. And I can't think of ever having done anything for myself that's going to be to be healthy,
mm-hmm.
and to be able to move and to be active and to know that, you know, I will be here in 20 years because I'm not going to die of a heart attack, possibly, or an obesity-related cause.
That has to feel a lot better. Keely Karka, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Keely Karka in New Albany, Indiana, and Dr. Mary Brandt in Houston, Texas at the Baylor College of Medicine. Thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure.
We're talking tonight about Obese America's boom in stomach reduction surgery. You can join the conversation. Did you watch Al Roker and Carney Wilson shrink before your eyes? Did they tempt you to stomach stapling? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the explosion in bariatric surgery, stomach reduction surgery. You may have heard it called stomach stapling, looking at the explosion in radical surgical intervention. to fight fat. The numbers are going way, way up. Many more Americans having this surgery than ever before. 10 million eligible. It may soon be expanded to 30 million eligible. What do you think? If the alternative is diabetes or early death, is this a godsend? Is this a rational response to obesity or a sign of some kind of cultural failure? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Cleveland, Ohio, by Paul Ernsberger. He's Associate Professor of Nutrition at Case Western Reserve University. And with me in the studio, Dr. Scott Shikora, Surgical Director at the Obesity Consult Center at Tufts New England Medical Center. He's done 1,000 stomach reduction surgeries, maybe more than that. We're joined right now from Sheboygan, Wisconsin, by Kate. Hi, Kate. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say I had my surgery, the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, exactly 1 year ago today.
Okay.
And I'm down 140 pounds.
From what to what, Kate?
I was at 401.
Okay.
And I'm now at 261.
And has that made a big difference in the way you feel in your health?
Oh, very much so. I don't have the problem in my knees. I lost both of my parents to diabetes, and two of my sisters have diabetes, so I wasn't diagnosed with it yet, but I saw what was coming, and I felt that this was, you know, after years and years of trying different diets, this was the only option for me to
deal with it. Kate, are you confident you're going to keep the weight off, or are you afraid it might eventually sneak back?
I'm more worried that I'm just done losing now. not so much that it'll sneak back. I've been on a plateau for quite some time, and it kind of scares me.
So you'd like to lose more since you went to such a great extent to deal with it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm hoping to at least lose another 100.
Scott Shikora, is that a reasonable expectation on Kate's part? She's gone from 401 to 260-something. Can she lose another 100? Will it be a natural outcome of the surgery?
Well, I don't know her height and what her body looks like. 100 may be a little optimistic, but she certainly could lose more if she continues to be physically active and watch what she eats and takes care of herself.
And Paul Ernsberger, here's a satisfied surgery patient. Does it make you say, well, okay, she's happy, fine?
Well, people's weight loss will peak around 1 year or 1.5 years, and then begins the process of regain, which is usually quite slow, but it progresses inexorably. I mean, that's the pattern that we see, unless the people are having severe complications. One remarkable thing is that people do seem to be very satisfied with this. I've talked to people who have been in and out of the hospital. They've been near death. They're in pain every day. They're vomiting.
After the surgery, you mean?
After the surgery, they're in pain every day, and they're vomiting.
Pain from what?
On a regular basis.
Pain from what? Why vomiting?
Well, vomiting, if you're intolerant to a number of foods, fibrous foods or meats, you'll throw those right back up. If you don't chew thoroughly enough, you'll throw it right back up. If you eat more than a couple of ounces of food accidentally, you'll throw it right back up. So there's a lot of this, reversal of fortune going on. But people will say, "Oh, it's great. I don't mind, having to run to the bathroom."
Well, they must be so relieved. They must be so relieved not to have to carry all that extra weight and the kind of imminent threat to health that might represent.
Yeah, and even when people have regained the weight, they've said, "Well, I would do it again in a minute." I think it's very difficult, for one thing, for people to admit that it might be a mistake, and it scares them to think that they may have made a decision that will, put their health in jeopardy for the rest of their lives. And unfortunately, I think that's the fact.
Kate, we wish you good luck in Sheboygan there. Diane is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Diana, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I have very, very strong feelings about this procedure, and I was so happy to hear someone address it along the lines of smoking, because I believe that generally the cause of obesity is, in fact, food addiction. I myself am a food addict, and I'm in a recovery program for food addicts, and I've been living in recovery for a number of years and have maintained a significant weight loss, and I know people who have maintained tremendous, tremendous weight losses for a long, long time, and I also know people who have had the surgery and who've gained all the weight back, and I just believe that the surgery is amounts to putting a Band-Aid on a broken leg. You know, what else can I say about it?
Diana, we've got it. Scott Shikora, thanks for your call. Scott Shikora, come back in here. You're hearing the kind of torn thoughts and emotions about this. Put aside for a moment the different interpretations about how it goes in the aftermath, and we can hear very different interpretations there. But clearly people, you know, some people have had it, and as Paul and our callers are saying, they had the surgery, they're happy with it, even if it's not easy. Others saying, gosh, this is a sign of things gone wrong. We need to deal with the fundamental addiction. Do I hear you saying that, look, we've got terrible obesity as a reality, and this surgery deals with it. Anything else is leaving these people out to face different kinds of mortality.
That's absolutely true. And an eating addiction is certainly one aspect of why people may become so greatly overweight. But look at society. We do heart surgery and vascular surgery for smokers. It's the same story, but no one's going out and saying we shouldn't operate on them. They've smoked and caused their heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
There's all sorts of addictions.
We do heart bypasses for butter eaters.
Exactly, and nobody is pointing a finger at them and saying you shouldn't have this procedure. You ate butter and developed coronary artery disease. These overweight people are desperate, however they got there. They're hundreds of pounds overweight. They can't exercise now. They may have the gene for obesity. They can't diet. They may have the environment that doesn't allow them to eat the way we would like them to eat. But they're stuck, and now they're diabetic, and now they have high blood pressure. And Dr. Ernstberger is correct. Even those that have had complications, and they are few. He makes it sound as if most. He is absolutely incorrect, unless the program he's involved with is a lousy program. But the majority of people, even if they've had complications, will come back and say, I will do it over again in a heartbeat because I never want to be that heavy again. We don't understand that as being non-obese people.
Let's try and get in a couple more calls here. Margaret's calling from Boston. Hi, Margaret. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm so excited that this program is going on tonight. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I wanted to echo some similar points that were made earlier, following up on what the doctor said from Texas about the comparison to smoking. I also, as the last caller, consider myself a food addict and am in a 12-step recovery program called Overeaters Anonymous.
Have you thought about surgery or not, Margaret?
No, I have not. And I am continuing to lose weight. My total weight loss at this point is 104 pounds.
How much do you weigh now?
I weigh 166.
So now you're way down in the healthy zone. But if you weighed 466, or I'm reading these stories, if you weighed 566 or 600 pounds, I mean, we have hospitals prepared to deal with 1,000-pound patients. Might you consider the surgery then?
Should I have found myself in a situation where it was literally life or death, it was maybe something that I would consider. But I know people who weigh 500 pounds who are doing it without this kind of radical intervention. And I do want to raise the point that it isn't blaming the patient to look at the root causes of obesity. And mm-hmm. I think that the reference to the Surgeon General earlier is a critically important point in terms of the way the food industry and social policy in this country is making everybody fat.
So let's change the culture, change the consciousness, you'd say. Margaret, thanks for your call. Paul Ernstberger, we're almost out of time here, but very quickly, as an alternative, what do you recommend?
Yeah, there's always alternatives. There are conservative medical treatments for all of the conditions associated with obesity, and it's not such a terrible thing to have a little breathing assist device that sits quietly on your nightstand. That's not terrible. It's not terrible to take a high blood pressure pill. It's not terrible to have to take, you know, a couple of medications for diabetes.
There's ways to live with it.
Mm. Yeah, these things extend life expectancy, and they have very few side effects. They've been proven safe and effective by the FDA. The surgery, the only controlled trials that have been done show that it's a wash.
Well, Scott Shikora, last word goes to you. You've got some happy patients out there. We can
hear
that.
Very happy patients, and I would say it is terrible to take insulin or to use a breathing machine at night or to have premature heart disease.
Well, it's a tough problem for the whole country, and we see some people dealing with it through surgery to avoid many problems there, and others wishing there were other ways and trying to pursue them. Dr. Scott Shikora, thanks so much for being with us
tonight. Thank you very much for having me.
Scott Shikora, Surgical Director at the Obesity Consult Center at Tufts New England Medical Center, and Paul Ernstberger in Cleveland, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Paul Ernstberger, Associate Professor of Nutrition at Case Western Reserve University. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, the primary authors of this week's Geneva Accord speak out. This is On Point. Israeli officials are fuming over Secretary of State Colin Powell's decision to meet with the organizers of the so-called Geneva Accord, an unauthorized model peace treaty for the Israelis and Palestinians signed in Switzerland this week. Israel's Vice Premier Ehud Olmert sharply criticized Powell, saying, "I think he is making a mistake. I think he is not helping the process." The Geneva Accord, which organizers hope will serve as a template for an official agreement between the two sides, calls for concessions that Prime Minister Sharon opposes, including the dismantling of Israeli settlements in Palestinian territories. The accord's main authors were in Washington today, making their first public address since Monday's signing. Speaking at the Brookings Institution, former Palestinian Information Minister Yasser Abed Rabo and former Israeli Justice Minister Yossi Beilin defended the non-binding accord against charges that it is irrelevant or worse. This excerpt begins with Yasser Abed Rabo.
"Some people accuse us of being dreamers or of talking about things that are irrelevant today, or maybe that we are not officials and why we are involving ourselves in these issues. I would say one thing. It's not the duty of the civil society, of people like us, of those who see that there is a continuous bloodshed, and of those who see that the two nations are heading from a disaster towards another disaster without any breakthrough. It's not their duty just to wait and observe until maybe the leaders, and maybe not, will decide to sit and negotiate and find a final solution. We do not replace the governments. We do not, and we didn't even think that we will take the place of those officials that should make a final deal. But we tried to find a solution that will motivate them, that will show the public opinion that there is a possible solution and that peace can come at the end. In the past 3 years, all kinds of hopes had deteriorated. And in the past 3 years, what was prevailing was continuous despair. And we thought that we needed to convince both public opinions first that we have to put an end to this despair. We can find an outlet and a solution."
With all due respect to ourselves, it is not an Abed Rabo Beilin agreement. On the Palestinian side, you have a very important group of people representing different parties and the civil society, the real civil society. On the Israeli side, you have people from the Likud, you have people from Shinui, you have people from Labor and from Meretz, you have the former defense establishment. It is very difficult to dismiss a former chief of staff, commanders of the police, a former head of the security service. All of them were there with us in Geneva the other day. You saw this group of people and said to yourself, well, this is not, if I may say so, the usual suspects of peace. This is a very different kind of group. And this is why the effort to dismiss it as a kind of an intellectual thing of politicians who are has-beens, who are searching for a career now, maybe through peace, who met with each other for 3 years because they had nothing else to do and signed the cover letter to the Swiss foreign minister. I mean, what you are having today is a very strange situation whereby the world is looking at it seriously, and that is why it is very difficult to look at it at home in a dismissive way.
Former Israeli Justice Minister Yossi Beilin and former Palestinian Information Minister Yasser Abed Rabo, the main authors of the Geneva Accord, speaking earlier today in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.